George Mueller of Bristol and His Witness to a Prayer-Hearing God, the originally authorized memoir by Arthur T. Pearson, author of The Crisis of Missions, The Acts of the Apostles, Many Infallible Proofs, etc., editor of the Missionary Review of the World, etc., with an introduction by James Wright, son-in-law, the work of George Mueller. Old Tappan, New Jersey, 1899. This book is in the public domain. Chapter 1. From Its Birth to Its New Birth. Human life, filled with the presence and power of God, is one of God's choice gift to His church and to the world. Things which are unseen and eternal seem to the carnal man distant and indistinct, while what is seen and temporal is vivid and real. Practically, any object in nature that can be seen or felt is thus more real and actual to most men than the living God. Every man who walks with God and finds Him a present help in every time of need, who puts His promises to the practical proof and verifies them in actual experience, every believer with the key of faith unlocks God's mysteries, and with the key of prayer unlocks God's treasuries, thus furnishes to the race a demonstration and illustration of the fact that He is, and is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. George Mueller was such an argument, an example incarnate in human flesh. Here was a man with like passions as we, and tempted in all points, like as we are, but who believed God and was embellished by believing, who prayed earnestly that he might live a life and do a work which should be convincing proof that God hears prayer and that it is safe to trust Him at all times, and who has furnished just such a witness as he desired. Like Enoch, he truly walked with God and had abundant testimony borne to him that he pleased God, and when on the 10th day of March, 1898, it was told us of George Mueller that he was not, we knew that God had taken him. It seemed more like a translation than like death. To those who are familiar with his lifelong story, and most of all to those who intimately knew him and felt the power of personal contact with him, he was one of God's ripest saints, himself a living proof that a life of faith is possible. That God may be known, communed with, found, and become a conscience companion in the daily life. George Mueller proved for himself and for all others who will receive his witness, to those who are willing to take God at his word and to yield self to his will, he is the same yesterday and today and forever. That the days of divine intervention and deliverance are passed only to those with whom the days of faith and obedience are past. In a word, that believing prayer works still the wonders which our Father told of in the old days of old. The life of this man may be best be studied, perhaps, by dividing it into certain marked periods into which it naturally falls. When we looked at these leading events and experiences like punctuation marks or paragraph divisions, as for example, 1. From his birth to his new birth or conversion, 1805 to 1825. 2. From his conversion to full interest unto his life work, 1825 to 1835. 3. From this point to the period of his mission tours, 1835 to 1875. 4. From the beginning to the close of these tours, 1875 to 1892. 5. From the close of these tours to his death, 1892 to 1898. Thus, the first period would cover 20 years, the second 10, the third 40, the fourth 17, and the last 6. However, thus unequal in length, each form a sort of epoch, marked by certain conspicuous and characteristic features which serve to distinguish it and make its lesson peculiar important, and memorable. For example, the first period is that of the lost days of sin, in which the great lesson taught is the bitterness and the worthlessness of a disobedient life. In the second period may be traced the remarkable steps of preparation for the great work of his life. The third period embraces the actual working out of the divine mission committed to him. Then for 17 or 18 years we find him bearing in all parts of the earth his worldwide witness to God. And the last 6 years were used of God in mellowing and maturing of his Christian character. During these years, he was left in peculiar loneliness. Yet this only made him lean more on the divine companionship, and it was noticeable with those who brought into most intimate contact with him that he was more than ever before heavenly minded, and the beauty of the Lord his God was upon him. The first period may be passed by rapidly, for it covers only the wasted years of a sinful and profligated youth and early manhood. It is of interest mainly as illustrating the sovereignty of that grace which abounds even to the chief of sinners. Who can read the story of that score of years and yet talk of piety as the product of evolution? In this case, instead of evolution, there was rather a revolution, as marked and complete as ever was found, perhaps in the annals of salvation. If Lord George Lidington could account for the conversion of Saul of Tarsus only by supernatural power, what would have thought of George Mueller's transformation? Saul had in his favor a conscience, however misguided, and morally, however pharisaic. George Mueller was a flagrant sinner against common honesty, decency, and his whole earthly career was a revolt, not against God only, but against his own moral sense. If Saul was a hardened transgressor, how callous must have been George Mueller. He was a native of Prussia, born at Koppenstedt, near Halberstadt, September 27, 1805. Less than 5 years later, his parents moved to Hammersbin, some 44 miles off, where his father had made a collector of the excise, again removed about 11 years to Schauenbeck, near Magdeburg, where he obtained another appointment. George Mueller had no proper parenting training. His father's favoritism toward him was harmful both to himself and to his brother, as in the family of Jacob, tending to jealousy and estrangement. Money was put too freely into his hands of these boys, hoping that they might learn how to use it and save it, but the result was rather careless and vicious waste, for it became the source of many childish sins of indulgence. Worse still, when it called upon to render any account of their stewardship, sins of lying and deception were used to cloak the wasteful spending. Young George systematically deceived his father, either by false entries of what he had received, or by false statements of what he had spent or had on hand. When his tricks were found out, the punishment which followed led to no reformation, the only effect being more ingenious devices of trickery and fraud. Like the Spartan lad, George Mueller reckoned it no fault to steal, but only to have his theft found out. His own brief account of his own boyhood shows a very bad boy, and he attempts no disguise. Before he was 10 years old, he was a habitual thief and had an expert at cheating. Even government funds entrusted to his father were not safe from his hand. Suspicion led to the laying of a snare into which he fell. A sum of money was carefully counted and put where he could find it and have a chance to steal it. He took it and hid it under the foot of his shoe. But he being searched and the money found, became clear to whom the various sums previously missing might be traced. His father wished him educated for a clergyman. Before he was 11, he was sent to the Cathedral Classic School at Hadestance to be fitted for the university. That such a lad should be deliberately set apart for such a sacred office and calling by a father who knew his moral obliquities and offenses seems incredible, but where a state church exists, the ministry of the gospel is apt to be treated as a human profession rather than a divine vocation, and so the standards of fitness often sink to the low secular level, and the main object in view becomes the so-called living, which is, alas, too frequently independent of holy living. From this time, the lad's days were mixed up with novel reading and various vicious indulgences. Card playing and even strong drink got hold of him. The night when his mother lay dying, her boy of 14 was reeling through the streets drunk, and even her death failed to arrest his wicked course or to rouse his sleeping conscience. And as we must always be the case when such solemn reminders make one know better, he only grew worse. When he came to the age of confirmation, he had to attend the class for preparation religious teaching. But this being to him a mere form, he met in careless spirit, another false step was taken. Sacred things were treated as common, and so conscience became the more callous. On the very eve of confirmation, and of his first approach to the Lord's table, he was guilty of gross sins, and on the very day previous, when he met the clergyman for the customary confession of sin, he planned and practiced another shameless fraud, withholding from him 11/12 of the confirmation fee entrusted to him by his father. In such frames of mind, and with such habits of his life, George Mueller, in the Easter season of 1820, was confirmed and became a communicant confirmed, indeed, but in sin, not only am immoral and unregenerate, but so ignorant of the very rudiments of the gospel of Christ, that he could not have stated to an inquiring soul the simple terms of the plan of salvation. There was, it is true, about such serious and sacred transactions a vague solemnity which he left a transient impression, and led to a shallow resolve to live a better life. But there was no real sense of sin or of repentance toward God, nor was there a dependence upon a higher strength, and without these, efforts of self-adamant never prove of value or work or lasting results. The story of this wicked boyhood presents but little variety except of the sin and crime. It is one long tale of evil doing and of the sorrow which it brings. Once, when his money was all recklessly wasted, hunger drove him to steal a bit of coarse bread from a soldier who was having a fellow lodger, and looking back long afterward to that hour of extremity, he exclaimed, "What a bitter thing it is to serve of Satan, even in this world." On his father's removal to Schoenbeck in 1821, he asked to be sent to the cathedral school of Magdeburg, inwardly hoping thus to break away from his sinful snares and vicious companions, and amid new scenes find help in self-reform. He was not, therefore, without at least occasional aspirations after moral improvement, but again he made the common and fatal mistake of overlooking the source of all truer betterment. God was not in all his thoughts. He found that to leave one place for another was not to leave his sin behind, for he took himself along. His father, with a strange fatuity, left him superintend sundry alterations in the house at Heisenbind, arranging for him to meanwhile to read classics with the resident clergyman, Reverend D. Nagel. Being thus, for a time, his own master, temptation opened wide doors before him. He was allowed to collect dues from his father's debtors, and again he resorted to fraud, spending large sums of his money and concealing the fact that it had been paid. In November 1821, he went to Mattingburg and to Brunswick, to which he later place his was drawn by his passion for a young Roman Catholic girl, whom he had met there soon after confirmation. In this absence from home, he took one step after another in the path of wicked indulgence, first of all by lying to his tutor that he got his consent to his going. Then came a week of sin at Mattingburg, and a wasting of his father's means at a costly hotel in Brunswick. His money being gone, he went to the house of an uncle until he was sent away. Then at another expensive hotel, he ran up bills until, payment being demanded, he had to leave his best clothes as security, barely escaping arrest. Then at Wolfenbüttel, he tried the same bold scheme again, until, having nothing for deposit, he ran off. But this time, he was caught and sent to jail. This boy of 16 was already a liar, a thief and swindler, and drunkard, accomplished only in crime, companion to convicted felons, and himself in a felon's cell. This cell, a few days later, a thief shared, and these two held converse as fellow thieves, related their adventures to one another, and a young Mueller, that he might not be outdone, invented lying tales of villainy to make himself out the more famous fellow of the two. 10 or 12 days passed on this wretched fellowship until disagreement led to a sudden silence between them, and so passed away 24 dark days from December 18th, 1821, until 12th of January ensuing, during which George Mueller was shut up in prison, and during which the part he sought as a favor of the company of a thief. His father learned of his disgrace and sent money to meet his hotel dues and other costs and pay for his return home. Yet such was his persistent wickedness that, going from a convict cell to confront his outraged but indulgent parent, he chose as companion in travel an invalid wicked man. He was severely chastised by his father and felt that his first make some effort to reinstate himself in his favor. He therefore studied hard and took pupils in arithmetic and German, French, and Latin. This outward reform so pleased his father that he shortly forgot as well as forgave his evil doing. But again, it was only the outside of the cup and platter that was made clean. The secret heart was still desperately wicked, and the whole life, as God saw it, was an abomination. George Mueller now began to forge what he afterward called a whole chain of lies. When his father would no longer consent to his staying home, he left, ostensibly for Halle, the university town, to be examined, but really for Nordhausen, to seek entrance into the gymnasium. He avoided Halle because he dreaded its severe discipline and foresaw that restraint would doubly irksome when constantly meeting young fellows of his acquaintance, who, as students in the university, would have much more freedom than himself. He returned home as he tried to conceal this fraud from his father. But just as he was about to leave again for Nordhausen, the truth became known, which made needful more links in that chain of lies to account for his systematic disobedience and deception. His father, though angry, permitted him to go on to Nordhausen, where he remained from October 1822 to Easter 1825. During these 2.5 years, he studied clerics, French, history, etc., living with the director of the gymnasium. His conduct so improved that he rose in favor and was pointed to as an example for other lads, and permitted to accompany the master in walks and converse with him in Latin. By this time he was a hard student, rising at 4 a.m. the year through and applying himself to his books till 10 at night. Nevertheless, by his confession, behind all this formal propriety, there lay secret sin, and utter alienation from God. His vices include an illness, which was for 13 weeks kept him in his room. He was not without a religious bent, which led to the reading of such books of Kloppen's work, but he neither cared for God's word, nor had any compunction for trampling upon God's law. In his library, now numbering about 300 books, no Bible was found. Cicero, Horace, Voltaire, he knew and valued. With the Holy Scriptures, he was grossly ignorant, and as different to them as he was ignorant of them. Twice a year, according to prevailing custom, he went to the Lord's Supper, like others who had passed the age of confirmation, and he could not, at such sessions, quite avoid religious impressions. When the consecrated bread and wine touched his lips, he would sometimes take an oath to reform, and for a few days refrain from such open sins. But there was no spiritual life to act as the force within, and his vows were forgotten almost as soon as made. The old Satan was too strong for the young Mueller, and when the mighty passions of his evil nature were roused, his resolve and endeavors were so powerless to hold him as he were new cords when he was bound, Satan to restrain him when he awoke from his slumber. It is hard to believe that this young man of 20 could lie without blush, and win the air of perfect candor. When dispassionate dragged him by the mire of debt, and his allowance would not help him out, he resorted again to the most ingenious devices of falsehood. He pretended that the money wasted in riotous living had been stolen by violence, and to carry out the deception, he studied the part of an actor. Forcing the locks of his trunk and guitar case, he ran into the director's room, half-dressed and feigned fright, declaring that he was the victim of a robbery, and excited such pity that his friends made up a purse to cover his supposed losses. Suspicion was, however, awakened that he had been playing the false part, and never regained the master's confidence. And though he had even then no sense of sin, shame at being detected in such meanness and hypocrisy made him shrink from ever again facing the director's wife, who, in long sickness, had nursed him like a mother. Since such was the man, who was not only admittedly to honorable standing as a university student, but accepted as a candidate for holy orders with permission to preach in the Lutheran establishment. This student of divinity knew nothing of God or salvation, and was ignorant even of the gospel plan of saving grace. He felt the need for a better life, but no godly means swayed him. Reformation was a matter of purely expediency, to continue in profligacy which would be final exposure, and no parish would have him as a pastor. To get a valuable cure and good living, he must make attainments in divinity, pass a good examination, and have at least a decent reputation. Worldly policy urged him to apply himself on one hand to his studies, and on the other hand to self-reform. Again he met defeat, for he had never yet found the one source and secret of all strength. Scarce had entered into Halle before his resolves proved frail as a spider's web, not able to restrain him from his vicious indulgences. He refrained indeed from the street brawls and dueling, because they would curtail his liberty, but he knew as yet no moral restraints. His money was soon spent, and he borrowed could he could find no one to lend. Then he pawned his watch and clothes. He could not be but wretched, for it was plain to what goal of his poverty and misery, dishonored and disgraced, such paths lead. Policies loudly urged him to abandon his evil doing, but his piety had yet no voice in his life. He went so far, however, as to choose for a friend young man, former schoolmate named Beda, whose quiet seriousness might, as he hoped, steadily his own course. But he was leaning on a broken reed, for Beda himself was a backslider. Again he was taken ill. God made him to possess the iniquities of his youth. After some weeks he was better, and once more his conduct took on the semblance of improvement. The true mainspring of all his well-regulated lives was still lacking, and sin soon broke out in unholy indulgence. George Mueller was an adept in the ingenuity of vice. What he had left pawned to get money, and with Beta and two others, went on a 4 days pleasure drive, and then planned a longer tour in the Alps. Barriers were in the way, for both money and passports were lacking. But fertility of invention swept all such barriers away. Forged letters, purporting to be from their parents, brought passports for the party, and books put in pawn secured money. 43 days were spent in travel, mostly afoot, and during this tour George Mueller, holding, like Judas, the common purse, proved, like him, a thief, for he managed to make his companions pay one-third of his own expense. The party went back to Haley before the end of September, and George Mueller went home to spend the rest of his vacation. To account plausibly to his father for the use of his allowance in a new change of lives was readily devised. So soon and easily were all his good resolves again broken. When once more in Haley, he little knew the time had come when he was to become a new man in Christ Jesus. He was to find God, and that discovery was to turn into a new channel the whole current of his life. The sin and misery of these 20 years would not have been reluctantly chronicled, but to make the more clear that his conversion was a supernatural work, inexplicably without God. There was a certain nothing in himself to evolve to such a result, nor was there anything in his environment. In that university town, there were no natural forces that could bring about a revolution in the character and conduct as such as he experienced. 1,260 students that gathered, and 900 of them were divinity students. Yet even of the later number, they all were permitted to preach. Not 1/100th part, he says, actually feared the Lord. Formalism displaced pure and undefiled religion, and with many of them, immorality and infidelity were cloaked behind a profession of piety. Surely such a man with such surroundings could undergo no radical change of character and life without the intervention of some mighty power from without and from above. What this force was, and how it was wrought upon him and in him, we are now to see.